This is a conversation with Beatrice Blake. Hi, Beatrice.
Hello, Serge.
So you have introduced focusing in a country where people did not know focusing.
Yes, I have. Yes, and that was my desire to do so because of experiences in the 80s when I was an acupuncturist in a clinic for Salvadoran refugees, and I was treating people that were fresh from the war, and I made some very good friends there and that are still my friends. And as the United States was going to war again and pushing, just watching this run up to war that happened in 2003, before the war in Iraq, I just felt, you know, my protesting against the war in Iraq doesn't seem to be having any effect, but perhaps I can offer something to the people that are still suffering from the last U.S. intervention in El Salvador.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I happened to be translating for a delegation from a large community organization in El Salvador, and we were traveling to visit organic farms in Maine and Vermont, and we had to ride around in a van for a long time. So in the back of the van, I taught focusing to the president of this large community organization, and he immediately got it and said, this would be really interesting for us because we have so many people that are still suffering the consequences of the war with no mental health care and nothing to do about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the background here is a very strong sense of alleviating suffering.
Yes. And then I happened to meet a woman who had been part of the guerrilla in the war for 12 years, who was very interested in alleviating her own suffering. She had lost both. She first married one soldier and then he was killed. She had a baby with him and he was killed. And then she got together with another man and had a baby and he was killed. And plus she was dedicated to the war effort as so many wonderful people were, really hoping and believing that it would bring a change. And then for 17 years after the war, there wasn't really that much change. And so she was very interested in solving her own mental, her own wounds from the war and in helping all the compañeros that she'd been with in the war. And so she just became the person that was organizing workshops for me to do. And she was the person that didn't really at first get what focusing was all about. So she said, you know, what people are interested in here and what will attract people is nonviolent communication, because everyone knows and realizes that we have a very violent society. So if we talk about it in terms of nonviolent communication, people will respond. And that was very true. I just saw people's eyes light up and people get engaged and interested. Mm-hmm. And that's how we started.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I went to the Community Focusing Lab, which I hope all focusers will know about. It's a group of people that are interested in forming, in teaching focusing outside the therapy room, just on a community basis. And It's a wonderful group of people, and we met for the first time in 2008, and we're still meeting once a month by phone. And anyone who's interested in the focusing community and wants to get support or test out a new idea or hear about what other people are doing, can contact me and or Nina Joy Lawrence, who's kind of the keeper of the flame of the Community Focusing Lab, and can join into our phone calls or our emails and really find support for any way from just how to bring focusing into your own family to how to bring focusing into your work to how to bring focusing to another country or another situation.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2008, I met Wendy Weber at the first Community Focusing Gathering, and she and I worked. She had immersed herself in nonviolent communication and focusing as well. So we developed a curriculum, and we tested it out in Brattleboro, Vermont, where we live, and it seemed to be very successful. And then I took that same curriculum down to El Salvador. And my friend Melba, who I was talking about earlier, was then working in the Central Market. And so she set up workshops in the Central Market. And we just tested it out and we saw how it worked. And eventually Melba and her daughter Yara are now certified focusing trainers, and they are now working in rural villages with resilience circles. And we're seeing that over time, the relationship that builds between the people in the circles and between them and the confidence that's inspired by Melba having been through the war and shared many of the same devastating experiences that they'd experienced. There's a healing that goes on there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's something about, you know, like a sense of care that I'm hearing, you're not just going there to, oh, I have this thing and here it is, but there's at a very deep level an attunement about what do they need? There's something that's interesting. What is it that, how could it be changed? How can we? And so you create this curriculum that is not just focusing, but has that nonviolent communication part. It can connect with people. And I'm hearing also a sense of that very strong connection that people have, with the person who is from there and has had all of these experiences and wounds and has absorbed it. And so in a way, even before we talk about method or teaching or anything else, it seems like there is a very strong, you know, it's embedded in a very strong desire for attunement and connection.
Yes. And I remember when I was just taking a short trip to El Salvador in 2008 and Melba invited me to her house, and we talked about what we could do together, and then we just lapsed into silence. And I remember it was the sunset, and we were just sitting there and sharing this beautiful, deep silence together.
Mm.
And that has turned into many talks around the dinner table with her whole family and listening and many, many changes that they've all gone through in their whole lives, in their lives and their relationships to each other. And it's almost like they're my family too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and there's certainly my, that feeling of collaboration, I think, is just, feels like a great gift between us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, in a practical way, you know, how did you approach introducing people to focusing in this context?
Okay, well, yes. Well, Salvadorans are very practical, can-do people, and they get impatient with stuff that's not practical, that's not showing them something that they can do. And that's why so many Salvadorans have come to the United States and are just known to be workers. They just work and they send their money back home. And so they're very, very practical people. And of course they went to war and they survived in a war for 12 years against the United States, with like making radios out of barbed wire and stuff like that. So they want practical things. So first of all, we talk about one process from nonviolent communication, which is jackal language versus giraffe language. Mm-hmm. And we just point out the differences that, you know, the giraffe has the biggest heart of all the mammals in Africa, 25 pounds. Mm. And it can, you know, get an overview of the situation. And yet the giraffes are very strong and they can defend themselves, and they're not pushovers, but they're looking for needs. They're looking for the needs behind what people say. And they, jackals are just kind of looking for who to name and blame, and kind of everything that we see here on the news and see here on the radio or the TV. That's pretty much jackal language.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Who to name and blame and criticize and point the finger at, and that doesn't really lead to anything. So the jackals are, I mean, the giraffes are looking for what is it that unites people. And it's really, we're all united by our beautiful human needs. So we teach about that. And then they do little role plays with the giraffe ears and the jackal ears, of really getting into like criticizing and being mean and as mean as they can. And then the giraffe listening to that, two jackals together fighting.
Mm-hmm.
That's really fun. And then a jackal listening to a giraffe. And then the inner process too, of listening to yourself as a jackal. You know, I'm no good. I'll never get this. I'm stupid. I'm, you know, whatever. And then listening to yourself as a giraffe. What do I need? What am I feeling? How am I right now?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that kind of all sets the stage for the focusing attitude.
Yeah. So the scrappy fighter, in a sense, like the observing self with the head of the giraffe, almost like from above the clouds, looking down on earth and seeing things from that distance and being kind-hearted and more benevolent. Yeah.
And also, really standing up for what they believe, like not allowing, really saying what their needs are, not allowing benevolence to and good-heartedness to keep them from saying, this is who I am and this is what I need. And when you did that action, I felt pain because I need, you know, respect, or mm-hmm. I need to feel safe, or I need, you know, connection,
right,
whatever.
Right. Right. So the powerful thing here is we're not talking about aggression versus giving in, but
right.
we're talking about two very powerful ways of standing up for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. How to really, and the whole thing shows, the experience of doing it shows that people really do have different needs. And so we can't assume in an interaction that the need that we think that person is coming from is the same need that we would feel. So that's also teaches about implicit intricacy and how each person is a universe, and each person has their own way of interpreting things.
Mm-hmm.
So the, I'm just going to slow down here. The neat thing about standing up for yourself and not, you know, you've got to tell people what you need because they don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They don't know that you need respect in that moment, or they don't know that you need a feeling of human warmth or whatever. It's learning how to express very clearly what your needs are in a way that people can hear. And part of the way that people can hear that is by saying, this is what I need, rather than, you know, you're a jerk. Why do you do such stupid things?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, it's a totally different language.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But so there's something, again, very powerful there about the context is you have a hard time. You've been beleaguered. You've been wounded. You've been hurt. There's a sense of an environment in which there is strife, and the answer is to not to give up on yourself,
right?
Because it could be a logical conclusion of that. I tried fighting, and it doesn't work, so I give up.
Right, and that is such. I'm so glad you said that, Serge, because that is the depression and despair that plagues many Salvadorans after giving their all. And yet it's these community organizations that have kept alive the desire for change. And those are the organizations that I was working through,
mm-hmm.
or that I am, that we're working through now. So there's a tendency, of course, to despair and depression. And I'm sure many, many people have gone through that. But there's also these wonderful people still working for the same goals, but in a peaceful way.
Mm-hmm,
and learning, and nonviolent communication can support. They know too much about war to have an illusion that war, another war, would change things for the better. So they're especially motivated to find these ways of working effectively, but in a strong, peaceful way.
Yeah, yeah. But it's also very interesting then if we look at then how focusing is introduced, is it may be mental health and it may be healing. But it's with that context of you're going to get what you need, you're going to be strengthened, you're going, you know, it's not just in a way, from the get-go, there's a sense of empowerment that's built into it, as
exactly.
opposed to a cure that you're down, we're going to, you know, it's definitely something that has to do with empowerment.
Yes, right. And that's very much with the Salvadorian ethos from the war when, you know, if you had a third grade education and you knew had learned how to read and you were in the mountains with your compañeros, you would teach them how to read.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you had only gone to like 1 year of medical school and then you left, you would be a medic and you would teach everyone everything you know. So there's this kind of each one teach one kind of mentality that's a very strong carrier of spirit through the whole alive part of El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the pairing and the empowering of focusing and working things out together is very much part of it. It's like a culture in which that could happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the introduction, if you want, of these people is through this jackal-giraffe exploration and discovering that there is a way in which they can very effectively assert their needs.
Right. And then the pause is that moment. Like Wendy Weber drew this figure eight, mm-hmm. and showed that the pause is right, that waist of the figure eight, in which, you know, something happens. And then you decide, do I want to spiral off into naming and blaming, which could eventually result in violence? Mm-hmm. Because they see the way that words, you know, connect with that eventual spiral of violence. Or do I want to go inside and ask, you know, what am I feeling? What am I needing? And then perhaps even ask, what does the other person feel and what do they need? So the pause is the moment in which you decide. And so we have a little diagram that we hand out to people. And there's this one band in the market that called it El Ocho, you know, the figure eight.
Yeah.
And he says, I tried the El Ocho the other night.
So what's what the, I understand that little waist and then how yeah. it goes there. But what's the first part of the figure eight?
The bottom part?
Yeah.
The bottom is where you go inside.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, what do I feel in this? You know, something impactful happens. Somebody mm-hmm. insults mm-hmm. me or threatens me or I feel bad about some event. And mm-hmm. then instead of naming and blaming, like, oh, so-and-so is crazy, you know, I'll never talk to them again. They're violent. They're crazy. They're weird. I go inside. I say, what was I feeling when so-and-so said that to me? And then in nonviolent communication theory, all feelings come from needs. So then you go deeper. What did I need? What was my need in that moment that wasn't met? Mm-hmm. And that's where focusing comes in, because the need I feel is very much on the felt sense level.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The emotion is an emotion, but the need takes you down to something deeper if you really pause to ask, what do I need?
Right, right. So in a way, you're hurt, you're attacked, some reaction that is perceived as an attack. And, you know, there's that thing of taking a moment to go inside and paying mm-hmm. attention to what's happening and
yeah.
understanding the totally human reaction, knee-jerk reaction, which is
right.
to react. And
right.
the react is going to be basically some form of aggression.
Yeah. If you decide to go up that way, yeah.
To go up that way,
yeah.
you know. But... you know, as you understand it, you give yourself a chance to feel it, and to, having felt it, in a way, see what's underneath it.
Exactly. Yes, that's
right. And the underneath that is, well, this is just the way we tend to react, but underneath it is a very deep need.
Yeah.
That's very hard to really immediately name. So you have to
yeah.
stay with it, you know, to get a sense of what it is.
Right, exactly. And that's where the focusing comes in. But initially, and in nonviolent communication, they give you lists of feelings and needs so you can see. Because a lot of times if you just ask somebody, well, what do you feel and what do you need, they'll just say, well, I feel that so-and-so's a jerk, you
right,
know?
Right.
So you have, actually, we give lists, and that's the way that introducing focusing this way in, for the first couple of years, it felt like, well, am I really introducing focusing? I don't think so. But now people really are doing focusing, but it just had to be, for me, even when I took nonviolent for communication for the first time, to see on a list that connection was a beautiful human need. It was a need. It wasn't mm-hmm. like, oh, you're just I don't know, weird or something, you know, oh, connection is a real human need.
Yeah.
So, and you know, the need for order, the need for beauty, the need to mourn. There's just a whole list and list of words that people can use to acquaint themselves with. Well, what is a need and what's the difference between a feeling and a need? And so there's another step after we teach about the jackal and giraffe language.
But maybe let's stay there for a moment because that's a big point. You know, in a way, no matter how people are introduced to focusing, there's always a moment where some people are going to say, well, a felt sense, what is it? And in a way, have that discomfort about, I don't know, you know. So what you're saying with this example is having a menu, like a multiple choice, is a very nice way to validate that there are many things that, you know, to give people ideas to check, you know, just like in a multiple choice, you would say, oh, is this this or is this that? And in a way,
so they're resonating.
They're resonating. So in a way, this is not a mechanical act, you know, as you're doing it, because it's a very, in a very simple way, you're introducing people with the experience of resonating. And then progressively as they develop into it, then, there is more of a background to know what to look for and to, and what to resonate with.
Yes. Thank you. That's true. And then another step to that is that we, well, then there's other steps which are just teaching people to listen in silence. And that's been very, very powerful, for many people and very unusual, something that had never happened before, to either be heard by someone or to listen to someone. And then there's the card game, which is developed by Lucy Liu, an NVC practitioner, to use in the prisons of California with prisoners and to try to teach them about NVC. And so there's these cards with feelings and needs written on them. And I learned that Salvadorans are very familiar with playing cards. Like at a funeral, the funeral parlor hands out decks of cards, because that the idea is that the mourners will stay longer with the bereaved if they're playing cards. So this whole thing of playing cards is familiar. And so a person tells something that happened for 3 minutes, and then the listeners have the cards and they offer feelings that they think might be what the person was feeling. But then the focuser gets to say, no, I wasn't. They get to discard anything that the person laid, other people laid down to try to interpret them that wasn't true. So again, they're resonating and they're seeing that the focuser is in charge. You know, yes, I felt distraught, but no, I was not frustrated. You know, they get to discern and see that they have a right to say and know what they were feeling. And then the person who told the story themselves goes through the cards of needs, and they, well, first of all, they see they've got maybe from a 3 minute story that they told, they've got maybe 15 feelings cards that make sense to them. And then they've got 15 or 20 needs cards. And so that's teaching about implicit intricacy, that wow, in that little exchange, there was all this happening inside me.
I mean, it's, I certainly see the implicit intricacy, but I also see very much the part of, you know, empathy, in a sense of, you know, it's not because I feel something that you felt necessarily the same way. And
right.
So that sense of the possibility of building bridges and of finding some attunement by trial and error.
Yes. And then the last step of the card game, the person next to the person who's laid down all their needs in front of them, the person next to them reads the needs cards to them. So that's teaching about reflection and how amazing it is to maybe for the first time in your life have someone validate your needs. So, and that gives, that almost always brings a shift that people can feel.
Right, right.
So it's like a way of producing the elements of a focusing experience in a way that people can experience it, but without just saying, just go inside and notice what you're feeling.
But, you know, even as you're saying it, I can imagine how profound it must be. And on the other hand, how, you know, the setting itself, you know, it's not just cards and people reading it, but there's, you know, that it is, you know, it's creating a certain mindfulness that people can hear it, not just as a word, but have the sense of resonance. You know, so I'm curious in a way of the setting itself in which this takes place, you know, to create the possibility, the invitation for people to have that little pause and hear and resonate and yes, no.
You know, if that's such an interesting question because the settings have been, the setting is, are totally different than what one would, the setting one would be able to create in the United States for teaching focusing. So we were bringing it to the people. So we were teaching in the middle of a market in these rooms with horrible acoustics and then maybe like halfway through the class, an evangelical preacher with a microphone would be right outside the window, like preaching hellfire and damnation, and you kind of have to wait till they stopped, or there'd be like people singing, or we'd be in this very tiny office. That's one moment that I'll never forget when we were in the rent collector's office in the market that was just cramped. And yet that moment happened where the one man told his story. People laid out the feelings cards. He laid out his needs cards. And then there's this just beautiful moment when his compañero right next to him, another man, read his needs to him, and you just saw his face change, and all of a sudden he felt so strengthened to stand up for what he was feeling. And so the situations are, you know, sometimes it's outside, sometimes when Melba worked in the hospital, we went to the basement, the sterilization unit of the hospital, which was like, it was like hot down there. And we would just teach to the people right in the middle of that kind of the bowels of the hospital. And, that's another reason why I like the games and I like the liveliness and definiteness of it, because there's very little quiet in El Salvador. There's always like a vendor saying, you know, tortillas, you know, mangoes. And so it just feels like a way that, at least for me, in work with the situations.
Right. So that people get engaged around the game. So that their attention is focused on that, and then, you know, it's more possible to ignore the distractions.
Yeah, right. And then eventually, now that Melba has worked with the same groups in the same villages for maybe 6 or 9 months, now there's that space where they know what's going on, where they're really going in and allowing themselves to accompany their own inner world, and they're feeling the healing, and there's that quiet and that attention. But maybe there's dogs running in and out, or babies or children, you know, still, but it's, and then I remember when I was there last time in February, I was in a group in Buen Pastor, one of the villages that where Melba has been working, and we were going to divide into focusing partnerships, which doesn't often happen also because people can't create the time to, you can't do focusing by phone because the phone system is a little different there. So usually they just meet in a group, and then I turned to this woman, and she just turned me and gave me the same beautiful, peaceful, warm, open attention that I would expect from focusers anywhere in the world. So.
Yeah. So if I had to use some words that come to me from, you know, to get a sense of what you're talking about, there's something about the resonance, you know, that comes very strongly. To get people, you know, to pause, to go beyond the knee-jerk reaction, to have some curiosity, and to develop to their capacity to check things out by resonating.
Yeah. That's, you got it. So
is there something else you might want to say to wrap it up, or do you feel that we got it?
Well, just to let people know that this way, this wonderful experiment in giving focusing away has been made possible by the donations from the focusing community, by people that believed in this dream that we had to bring focusing to people that couldn't pay for it, that, you know, that are living in poverty and yet have so much spirit. So, we really need, financial support to be able to continue. And we also need ideas of how we can become self-sufficient and, or ideas for grants that would apply to what we're doing. That's all. It more and more people are asking for our services, and the funding that usually supports NGOs in El Salvador has been from Spain, and Spain's having a very difficult financial time now. So the connections that we have and that we've made are unable to help us very much right now. So I just want to also express the gratitude and the vision of focusers in Holland, Japan, United States, all over the world that have donated to make this wonderful dream come true. And we have a newsletter, and we can love to have people on our mailing list, and you can keep up with all the latest things that are happening, which include I'm going to go to Holland with Melva's son, Nicholas, in July, and Renee Voglers and Harriet, too, are going to share their wonderful children focusing training with him, because he's often taking care of the children while Melba's doing the circles. So we'll have both the children and the parents learning focusing at the same time. So that's very exciting.
Great. Thanks, Beatrice.
Thank you, Serge.
This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.